rebound if necessary. And we are dealing with Roman numeral 5 on page 4. Finished up point B, that it's easy and convenient to define rich as just above what we have. And so therefore this doesn't apply to me because I'm not rich. Well, first, whether you're rich or not really doesn't enter into this. What we're talking about is materialism. Are you a materialist? Does this occupy an inordinate place in your life that it shouldn't? So see, nevertheless, most of us do not need to hear the warning that although money in itself is not sinful, actually we do need to hear the warning. Let me rephrase that. It contains a danger that is both real and serious. There is nothing, money is benign. Money is like anything else, any other object. Objects are benign. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Knives don't kill people. People kill people. Guns and knives are benign. They can be used for good or bad. Money is the same way. Can be used for good or bad. So, if somebody gets killed with a golf club, we're going to outlaw golfing? I don't think so. At least I hope not. So, again, these things are benign, and money in itself is benign, but it can be bad. It can be very bad, and especially if you don't live on a budget, you don't maintain your priorities, you don't have the number one priority in place, which should be the support of doctrine. And so you have to sit down and make out a budget. And number one is my grace giving. Number two, whatever, rent and all the things that you have to have, and a car and gas and clothing and utilities and on and on and on the list goes. We recognize that you got to have these priorities. You can't just tell FPL one month, I'm sorry, you weren't on my priority list this month. We'll try it and see what happens. But I think you'll find yourself functioning pretty soon without electricity if you don't pay that bill. So, again, spending money in areas where we don't need to spend money. One of the things I have harped on, and because of the nature of the beast, the way the world works with the telecommunications issues and the way it's all transpiring with the companies merging and everything, these people are getting harder and harder pressed for money, so they have to sell you amenities. Call waiting, caller ID, call forwarding, conference calling, this calling, that calling, pretty soon you got a $15 phone bill that becomes a $45 phone bill because you got all these details on it that are just really not necessary. So I picked that because it's pretty obvious. Nobody needs caller ID, frankly. You can, if you have it, don't feel bad. I'm not down on you. I'm not mad. But nobody needs, it's not a need. Like I said, we used to live on the edge. I still live on the edge. I just pick up the phone not knowing who it is. It's scary, but I managed to make it. Do you just have to know who it is before you pick up the phone? Why? Get a little excitement in your life. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe you need some excitement. Guess what? I pick up the phone. I hear that pause that tells me it's a solicitor. I don't even wait. I hang up. All the thing it took me was the extra 5 seconds it took me to get up and answer the phone. So I haven't wasted much. But even if I had caller ID, I'd have to walk over there and look at it. It's not like you carry it around with you. So I pick on those things only because those things are obvious, that these aren't things people have to have. You can live without those things. Most of us already have more money than we need. Rather than cutting back on our efforts toward affluence, we continue trying to elevate our standard of living even more. One, when compared with the time in which the Bible was written. And if everybody wants to go back and live in Bible times, this would be fun. We'll get rid of our indoor plumbing, and we'll get rid of electricity, and we'll get rid of a lot of things, really, that come to make our life pretty comfy. So when the Bible was written, we have so many more details paraded past us that few people suffer from a troubling accumulation of funds. You say, well, I don't have as much money in the bank as I'd like. Why? Well, but I've got every detail known to man. Well, that could explain why you don't have much money in the bank. So you have to prioritize. Well, what's the most important? To the persistent advertising barrage we endure, the well-stocked stores we frequent. Did it ever occur to you that most third world people have never even seen the inside of a Publix and that they would freak out if they knew this sort of affluence and abundance was available in, 5 minutes from your house? 2 minutes? And how many stores do we have within driving distance? Well, lots, obviously, because we say you can drive 20 minutes, but even within 10 minutes, of here. How many grocery stores and how much food is in this 10-minute area? The Publix, Cash and Carry, you know, on and on and on. Albertsons, Winn-Dixie, who all ever is still out there available. So again, we are used to this. We get inured to it because we take it for granted. The fact that many things are priced within our reach makes it all too simple to convince ourselves that we really need this one more thing. And then you know what happens when you get it, don't you? You're happy for about what? A day? A week? A month? Then you need something else. This is the way it works. Three, ironically, many have been heard to claim that they are just getting by while accumulating a choking degree of financial prosperity and multitudes of details. There isn't anybody here that I've observed in this congregation that's just getting by. So nobody better try that one on me. We're just getting by. What? You're spending money in places and on things that have nothing to do with just getting by. So we all have to deal with this. None of us are just, I'm not just getting by. So, and I don't think anybody else is. For since we are so prosperous in the details and not often in cold hard cash, and because many of our neighbors enjoy the same or greater levels of prosperity, we deny that we're rich. And five, unfortunately, this leads to a situation in which we play into the hands of our sin nature and fail to watch for the signs that our affections are being diverted by our possessions. And so we have to, again, this is something that's, and it's easy for people to do. One of my things, I work on this job, and oftentimes my boss is spending other people's money. You know, it's fun spending other people's money. And if I'm spending other people's money, well, why not have the highest and the best? I mean, why not? It's other people's money. It's not costing me anything, really. So let's go for the gusto. Let's get everything. Don't buy Bush, buy Sam Adams. Buy the best beer you can get. Buy Löwenbräu or whatever you think happens to be great. You know, and I'm not down on any of these things. All these things have their place. What we're talking about is trying to keep these things in their place where they're not that important. And again, and certainly you can ride above every beer destined to perish. But you can also write that above your house and your car and your computers and all the things that we have. We all have them. So we have to, again, the challenge is to keep our priorities straight, keep focused on what's really, truly important. Everybody acknowledges the difficulties of being hungry. Too few are honest about the difficulty of being full. Philippians 4:11 through 13. And the fact is, did anybody here miss a meal yesterday other than if they wanted to? No. We didn't. We won't miss one today either. I plan on eating right after Bible class, frankly. I usually work up an appetite in here. You may say, well, this is easy. Well, you come up here and do it. And I'll sit out there and think how easy it is for you. And trade places. Philippians 4:11, not that I speak from want. For I have learned to be, what? Content. Content is not a four-letter word, people. In whatever circumstances I am. But here's the key. One of the things you know, and you know who pointed this out to me was Greg Neese about 25 years ago. Now, those of you who know Greg know who I'm talking about. And he said that really jumped out at him in this verse when he was studying it was that Paul learned. He didn't know how to be content. He had to learn it. We all have to learn it. It doesn't come naturally to us. Some of us are more content than others, but the fact is it's very easy to become discontent in the culture in which we're immersed. And everybody's got a better husband, a better wife, a better car, a better job, a better this, a better that, more details. You know, just because you've got money doesn't mean it's God's will for you to spend it. Some people, you know, they get a nickel and it burns a hole in their pocket. And there's other people so tight that you couldn't get change for a nickel from it. I only have 3 pennies. All right. And they, you know, as we say, they squeeze the buffalo on the nickel. Guess what? Okay, you don't want to, those are extremes. You don't want to be this spendthrift that every time you get something, my God, I've got some money. It's God's will for me to spend it. How happy, yeah, the precious. Or I can't ever part with anything because I need this money. It is the precious. And then you hoard it. And guess what? Your money is a means to divine good production. You've got to look at it that way. Your money, you're not here to get rich. I can't find any verses in the Bible that say, believe in Jesus Christ and thou will be rich. I just haven't found that one yet. And so we have to use our money wisely. We can get a great deal of SG3 by using our money wisely. We can get a great deal of SG3 on the job. We can get a great deal of SG3 for a lot of things. But some people, they spend and spend and spend. I got it. It's God's will for me to spend it. No. Stop right there. It's not necessarily God's will for you to spend it just because you have it. He also wants you to plan for the future. Read Proverbs. Hey, go to the ant, you sluggard. He works hard in the summer and he puts his food up, and then, you know, remember the old story with the ant and the grasshopper? The grasshopper played all summer and the ant worked hard. And then when the winter came, well, give me some of your food. No. And some people look down on the ant. Bad ant. No, the ant was smart. It was the grasshopper that was the idiot. And I'm supposed to feel bad because some idiot won't work all summer, and then I'm supposed to give him money so he can live during the winter? Pass. Thanks, but no thanks. So you should have a savings account. There's nothing wrong with having some money in the bank for unexpected things. Everybody's going to have something unexpected happen. How big or little it is really irrelevant. Have you planned ahead? What does Paul tell the Thessalonians? Work quietly. Make it your ambition to work quietly. Do your job as unto the Lord. And have enough for your own self and enough to help others also. So, well, I'd like to be able to give to Living Grace, but I've got 14 car payments, 2 house payments, and all this other stuff I got to pay for. Well, we don't have a Living Grace need, by the way, but that's just the idea of it. I can only do so much. Well, cut back then. I know those are bad words, cut back, in America. They're never spoken in polite company. But cut back. It won't kill you. And we've gotten this idea. And one of the things you've learned in life is that once a person attains a certain level of prosperity and abundance, it's very difficult for them to step back and say, you know what, I don't need all that. Because then we begin to get reliant upon it. That's the danger. So, Ephesians or Philippians here, 4:11 through 13. I know how to get along with humble means. I know how to live in prosperity. Most people, you know, they have this idea, smite me with incurable prosperity. I can handle it, Lord. No, you can't, or you would have it. God doesn't give it to you in many cases because we cannot handle it. The fact is, I've learned in my own Christian life, and I dare say most of you have probably figured out, you work better on a short leash. If God gives you too much rope, what do you end up doing? I could fashion a noose. I could hang myself. I could make a hat, you know. Any of those things, but we end up hanging ourselves sometimes because God gives us a little freedom. And how do we handle it? By using good judgment, by planning financially, and by using common sense? No. We write checks as fast as we can write them. And if we, hey, God forbid you forget your check, but I got the ATM card. I'm golden. So, and then people get into trouble with those. I'm sorry, I'm 50 years old, never had an ATM card, and I'm not going to have one. You know why? Don't need it. I've lived 50 years without it. And I know you think I'm backwards. I don't care. I've never gotten overdrawn at my bank because I forgot to write down an ATM withdrawal, though. That's kind of nice. Has that ever happened to you? You say, nobody wants to raise their hand. Well, and if you have an ATM card and you can handle it, fine. But most people can't handle it. That's the sad reality. Most people are fiscally irresponsible. And you see it all the time. I have learned the secret of being filled and of going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And the Bible doctrine and the inner man will give you the power to see these things correctly and to apply in these areas. So you say, well, other people make more than I do. What difference does that make? There are other people that make less than you do. But again, we always conveniently define rich as something above what we have. And that's convenient, but unfortunately it's not true. For obvious reasons, we pray not to be stricken with poverty. However, if we understood what the realities are, we might not pray to be stricken with wealth. Proverbs 30:8-9. So everybody's got an income of some sort. You got to budget that income. You got to live within that budget. And I know people, you know, I've had many conversations with this over the years with believers. And some of them said, well, Ron, you're too hard-nosed about this. But, you know, we got a budget. We have X amount budgeted for food. That's what we're going to spend on food. We're not going to go to the grocery store with a blank check and just buy whatever I feel like buying today. You get a list. You make your list out. You stick to it. You stick to your budget. And that's just one area, groceries. You know, we're not prone to go out and buy gas just because we get a whim, are we? Oh, I think I'll get some extra gas. That's not the kinds of things we're buying, is it? No, but I think I need this, and it hits me. I need it. I've seen it on TV. I know I need it. I know I've got to have one of those things. I know I'm not much for female perfume, but I've got to have that. I won't wear it even, but I'm going to buy it because it'll make me happy. Because I succumb to the commercials, and I listen to them sing and dance. God help us. We're the stupidest society on the planet, pretty much. And hopefully, and again, hopefully believers won't fall into this stuff. And this is why we talk about this and deal with this, so you don't fall into this stuff. Be wise. Realize that God expects you to be a good steward. Just as he expects me to be a good steward of the doctrine he's provided me and share it with you and have all my ducks in a row so I can get up and teach. He expects you to have your financial house in order. And that might mean cutting back. That might mean doing some other things. That might mean living on a budget. Budget's not a dirty word either. Proverbs 30:8-9, keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. And so these are good advice, very good advice. One critical danger of wealth is that it tends to draw our attitude, our trust, and our gratitude away from God and toward the money and details we have accumulated. The fact is, when you don't have any money in the bank, it's much easier to rely on God, isn't it? Well, you don't have any choice now, do you? But if you got money in the bank, well, I don't have to worry about anything. I'm fixed for the future. Recognize that God can change your entire life and turn it upside down in an instant. And you could lose everything. And all the things that you trust in. I mean, we've seen the middle class wealth get decimated through this whole IRA situation. And we're not against IRAs either. If you got an IRA, fine. That's planning for the future. Good. But how many people bought these IRAs and now they're worth less than what they put into them? That sounds like a scam to me. I don't know. But if it's... Give me your money and I'll save it for you. Trust me, I am not a crook. 11:28, he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. And also 1 Timothy 6:17. So, again, we have to deal with these issues. This is as important to your Christian life as probably anything else. This is as important as being faithful to your husband or wife. This is important as raising your children. And what do we teach our children about money? They learn much of their attitude about money from their parents. Now, there's obviously that fruitcake that won't listen. And, you know, the parents do all the things right and demonstrate physical and financial stability and handle their niche well. And then there's that child that runs out and is an idiot. Well, you can't do anything about that. But that's the exception. Most of our kids learn from us what they see. 1 Timothy 6:17, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited. That is, of course, as you know, one of the things that people get into, they become arrogant over their riches. And certain people, they just have a look of contempt on their face when dealing with the riffraff around Sarasota. Away with you, riffraff. We're here for cultural entertainment. We're cool, and you're not. Go away. Oh, yeah, come and mow my lawn. Clean my pool. Do this, do that. But don't show up at the movies when I'm there. I don't like sitting next to that sort of person. I've got more money than they do. So conceit, arrogance, fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Your money has wings on it, by the way. Remember that. It can fly away. But God can dissipate it for you. And he does to some people. They won't honor him from their wealth. They won't get their priorities right. God gets his, trust me. You say, well, I don't believe in giving anything. Good for you. Don't believe in getting, though, either. Because you reap what you sow. So, and again, what people give, that's their business. We understand that. But if you're not, if you don't have your first priority straight with God, how do you expect he's going to bless your finances? As it says in the Gospels, if you're unfaithful in a little thing like money, how are you going to be faithful in a big thing? The answer is you won't. Your attitude towards money very often betrays your attitude towards other areas of life. So tell them to fix their hope not on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us all things to enjoy. While Jesus addressed this issue of earthly treasures and our hearts, some of us naively assume that whatever dangers wealth may involve for other people, we're immune to them. Matthew 6:21, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this, is no one is immune to it. I'm not immune to it. You're not immune to it. No one's immune to it. I was talking to some believer the other day who I'll, you know, remain nameless just for their, you know, privacy. And they said, well, you know me. I got it spent before I make it. And I thought, what do you say to that? And I count this person as one of my real dear friends. But I just wanted to grab him by the throat and say, what is wrong with you? I got it spent. What are you doing spending money you don't have? What makes you think that's being a good steward? It's not. You got to live on a budget. And that means, you know, I got money to pay this bill. Where is it? Well, it's not here yet. Okay, let me explain something to you. I have money. Now, this is a pretty simple sentence. I is the subject, have is the verb, and money is the direct object. You possess the money. That means you have it, you possess it. In this context, where's the money? Well, I don't have it. Not have it. What does is mean? What is to be verb? State of existence. How do you define is? It sounds like you're obfuscating, President Clinton. So, I got it spent before I get it. What? That is not being a good steward of anything. And don't expect that God's going to bless you with that attitude, frankly. And this person, who is one of my dear friends, is constantly under financial pressure. And if you live your life constantly under financial pressure, it will destroy you and it will destroy your marriage. You can take that one to the bank. Now, the number one cause of divorces in this country is finances. And irreconcilable differences. Yeah. Finance, you can't live, you weren't meant to live under that kind of pressure all the time. I couldn't live that way. I could not live that way. And it's not as though I've been afraid to work hard or whatever. When I first got down here, I took the job at the cabinet shop. And if you think hauling around cabinets down at, you know, Fort Myers and Marco Island and all over this place is fun when the heat index is 110, you can forget it. I'm here to tell you it wasn't. And some of you work outside all the time, so you know. You know what I'm talking about. And so I was willing to do anything, but, you know, there were times when we were just flat broke. I look back at the checkbook, that we were $5 between us and poverty. But you know what? God always took care of us. And we kept our finances in order, even when we had little. And then God begins to bless you if he sees he can trust you. But guess what? Some of you aren't trustworthy when it comes to money. You do not handle it. You won't handle it. And you better learn how to. It will destroy you. This is as serious as any other doctrine, as far as I'm concerned. Matthew 6:21, and I think the Bible's pretty straight on this too. Actually, verse 19, stop laying up for yourselves. It's a present imperative in the Greek. It's not an unconditional deal. It's stop doing an action already in progress. Stop laying up for yourselves treasures on earth, They're subject to several things: moth, rust, and thieves. They're subject to external pressures. They're subject to decay, the natural order of things. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Now, how do I do that? Well, that gets into applying doctrine and recognizing the potential for SG3 in all things. And part of that gets into your finances. And how you handle your finances every time you function under grace giving as a believer. And you give, and that's why we make it private. We don't, you know, we don't want you hollering, "Hey, I got 50. We don't care what you're giving. If you give, you give. That's your business. If you don't give, you don't give. That's your business. But we also will point out, we try to make it as private as possible. We don't care who gives what. The only person that knows is the treasurer, and we never discuss it. And we never will. Been here 15 years. I'm not going to start now. I'm going on 16 now. I'm not going to discuss it. Don't care. All we'll have for you at the financial report is the end of the year is X amount of dollars came in, and here's where we spent it and how. And so, every time you function under grace giving, you're laying up treasure in heaven. If you're in fellowship, you're doing it for the right reason. That's a pretty easy application, isn't it? I write a check for $50 and I got reward in heaven, or pick the amount, a $5,000 or whatever, or five, or 50 cents. I wouldn't write a check for 50 cents, frankly. It probably cost more to print the check than it did for that, but. The point is, every time you do that, you're laying up treasure in heaven. When you help another believer that has a need, and this all has to be done in the confines and in the parameters of doctrine. We don't just go around throwing money to everybody who says, "Oh, I got a need." First thing we have them fill out a deal, living grace request form. I got a need. Okay, what is it? I need money to pay my rent. Why? Where are you working? Oh, I'm not. See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya. We're not going to help you if you're not working. You can just forget about that. It doesn't work that way. Because the First Thessalonians passage has to factor into that. So when you help another believer, if they need it, number one, pray about it. Stop and make sure it's legit before you just start writing checks. There are some people, they've got the, I love it, and I've always referred to it as this, I know how to fix it. Throw money at it. You can throw money at a lot of things. It doesn't necessarily fix them, as Jesus pointed out. The poor you have with you always. So there's always going to be a problem with poverty. That's not going to change. So, and we're not against helping people, but when you're in fellowship and you do it right and you help them, boom, treasure in heaven. And you used your money to get it. That's pretty easy. When you sit here in Bible class in fellowship, you're laying up treasure in heaven. Under the filling ministry of God, the Holy Spirit, taking in doctrine, this is pretty easy SG3, isn't it? Say, "Well, I have to listen to you." That's the rub, isn't it? There's the rub. So for where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. The heart is the current you, the you that exists right this second. Where's your treasure? If it's not in heaven, you're maladjusted at some level. You've got to get your focus on what's important. 19 also, this chapter, or this book, 23 through 24. And we saw it here as we opened up this doctrine, or this study, we might say, with this issue of this young man. And he went away sad because he had great possessions. He owned much property. Couldn't liquidate anything to follow Jesus. Well, how many chances do you think people got on this during the incarnation? This guy is forever recorded now as a negative example. The problem is, here we are in human history. When Jesus was alive on planet Earth, the time to make the applications to him or for him were then, right there. And this guy didn't do it. Now you and I are up on the stage of history. Now it's our time. Now we're at the bat. Bottom of the ninth. Bases loaded. Two out. Down two runs. What are we going to do? Let's send Joe Blow to the plate. Uh-oh. Joe Blow don't play too good. There you go. Well, it's your swings now. You got the ball's in your court. Truly I say to you, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Why? Because they tend to trust their wealth and not God. They tend to rely on other things. And the poor disciples, they're just flabbergasted by this. Well, wow, whoa. We thought all the rich were saved. Then the disciples said, they were very astonished and said, then who can be saved? And all things are possible with God. God can get around this if they're positive. So again, this is something that affects us all. We have to watch for it, have to be aware of it, have to acknowledge it for what it is. Six, how the pursuit of money is harming us. A, in our character. One, material motivations and economic values have already eroded and are eroding godly virtues and character qualities. For some people, it's all about the money. Guess what? At a certain point, you've got to adopt the attitude that the money doesn't matter. That's what you have to have. And every detail you have, every bit of things that you acquire, you better hold them with an open hand. Because God gave them and he has the right to take them away. As Job personified that very well. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And when all this, he never sinned or imputed injustice or unrighteousness to his God. And so the reality is, of course, though, that Job recognized, okay, this blessing came from God. This Abraham demonstrated mastery of this when he was willing to sacrifice Isaac, his only son. This was God's great blessing that had been promised all those years, and here it is. Now give it back to me. What? Are you insane, Lord? Isaac, Abraham passed the test. He was willing to do it. So everything you've got, you better hold with an open hand. Two, many Americans have glorified the wrong types of people. Those making the most money and enjoying the highest standard of living all too often have the worst character. Let's see, what's the average Hollywood marriage now? About 16 minutes? I want you to grow up and be like J-Lo or Britney or Madonna or any of these other people. Jack Nicholson, he's an example of a guy with great character, isn't he? Who do we promote and set up there as our great American idols? Guess what? Don't worry, once the cosmos gets a hold of them, they'll run them through the ringer. So we these people are paraded before us, the Dennis Rodmans of this world. And they write books. And look at the character of our last president, Clinton. And we're supposed to think that this guy's great? Give me a break. Three, consider the consequences to the credibility of Lot and to the character of his family for moving his family to Sodom for reasons that were primarily economic. Genesis 13:1 deals with the initial move. Because this betrays, and as a matter of fact, it not only betrays, it definitively states it here. What was Lot's priority? Oh, I'm sorry, it's Genesis 13:10. I said 1. And so Abraham tells him, separate from me. Verse 9, there's not enough room for us to conveniently hear. The herdsmen are getting in quarrels. I want peace, so we're not gonna fight over this. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Just as this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of Jordan. He took present advantage over spiritual priorities. Lot was all about the present, the here and now, of making money, of getting ahead. And in chapter 19, we see this as he's delivered from this situation by God, and possibly through the prayers of Abraham. And so he's moved to Sodom. His daughters are hanging out with these queers every day. I wonder how that affects women. Well, they get into the fashion business. And the queers tell them how they should dress and what's cool and how to look. And you got to believe, you know. But at least his daughters, to their credit, were engaged. They didn't engage strictly in the culture there. So they were told. Lot goes out to try to explain to them, hey, this place is going to get destroyed. In verse 14, and Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters. They weren't married at that time. This was a part of the betrothal process. But legally, they were in a binding situation. Said, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be a joke, to be jesting. They didn't take him serious. Why? Because they didn't take him serious in the first place. Lot was not a person you had a great deal of respect for. And Lot was a believer, but here's how Lot ends up. Verse 30, Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in the cave with his two daughters, and you know the rest of the story. That's really edifying, isn't it? Well, the old B-I-B-L-E. I didn't write it. I just have to teach it. So look at Lot's character. Look at his daughter's character. Look at his sons-in-law died. Look at his wife. And are we to suggest that this had nothing to do with his materialism? It was all too much because of it. For a good example of the consequences that covetousness has in a person's character, simply consider the inner character of Judas Iscariot. And he's an unbeliever, of course, whereas Lot was a believer. But John 12:6. And this gets into, there's a supper. In verse 3, Mary took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor people?" Now this he said not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a sneak thief. And he had the money box. He used to pilfer what was put into it. And so people would make donations to Jesus' ministry, and there's old Judas scamming a little on the side for himself. Hey, I'm administrating this fund. I need to be paid. Got to get paid. Everybody wants to get paid, don't they? Well, guess what? So he was a sneak thief. There's a separate word here for, like, as opposed to the kind of guy that comes up and robs you face to face. And Judas is the kind of guy that would appropriate funds as he saw fit. And it was for him. Well, B, in our families, one, can it be denied that in many instances we are losing our families to materialism, which includes the details of pursuit, the pursuit of details and fundsville. I'm all for vacations. Everybody needs a break, so don't ever feel guilty about taking a vacation. I'm going to take one. I try to take at least two a year just to get away and get my head clear. And if I could go to a place where the angelic conflict wasn't, I would go there. But I haven't found a place like that on the planet yet. And so there's nothing wrong with vacations. But some people, vacations becomes the pursuit of their life. They live for their vacations. Sure, we all need time off. We all need to get away. That's healthy. We're all for that. So, but the pursuit of Funsville. I can't just go on a vacation and have a little fun. I've got to take a 31-day cruise. Well, wouldn't a 5-day cruise sort of do the same thing? No. Are you insane? I can't go to Florida. I've got to go to Hawaii. We're not against Hawaii. The less that come to Florida right now, as far as I'm concerned, the better. But the point is, we've got to do this and this and this. How have you lived until you've done this? And people get off on their little tangents and their little favorite things. For, you know, have you got TiVo yet? TiVo is the be-all and end-all of life. Have you been scuba diving yet? You can't live. You haven't lived until you've scuba dived. On and on and on. And have you climbed Everest yet? No? Oh. I can't even talk to you. Do all these things that people do, all these experiences, make them happy? If it made them happy, how come they got to repeat it again in 6 months? If there was really true lasting happiness there. And we're not against going places or doing things. If you want to go climb Everest, go for it. Don't miss any class. You got to keep that priority straight. See, sometimes some things are not sinful in themselves, but they're out of bounds for us because they distract us from what's really important. They become, you know, they may be a priority. I'd love to see the world. I'm going to wait till the millennium, though. I think I'll be able to enjoy it a little more then. But, you know, if people want to go places and see things and all that, you know, fine. But don't think it's going to make you happy. And don't convince your kids that the be-all and end-all of life is Vegas or Reno or wherever it happens to be. These places are, Vegas. Now, that's a good place that really promotes values. But if people go to Vegas, I don't look down my nose at them. Oh, you went to Vegas. You're a dirty believer. No. If you want to go to Vegas, I don't care. But don't go gamble your house away. That would be stupid. And, you know. So, two, are we not sacrificing real life and real relationships sometimes for money and the things it can buy? Three, for materialistic and worldly rewards. Many husbands and fathers are expending themselves so completely on their careers that they have little, and in some cases, nothing left to give to their families. Four, significant, well-rounded male leadership in the home is rare. Since men are often completely so tired from providing a certain standard of living, they have nothing left. They have little left emotionally, physically, or spiritually for their loved ones. Guess what, guys? You aren't going to be judged at the Bema seat by how well you provided for your family. You're going to be judged for how well you raised your family. And that's a huge difference. And so we recognize the leech has two daughters. Give, give. That's in the Bible too. That was not just off the top of my head. That's a verse in Proverbs. They're never satisfied. Sometimes we need to look at our families and say, you know, you got enough. This is it. We don't need any more. And I'm not going to kill myself to get any more. And guess what? Step back. Hey, God will bless you in this, trust me. Get off this treadmill. You're wasting a lot of energy on a treadmill and you're not going anywhere. That's the one thing about treadmills. I tend to find they're stationary. So again, why do we have some of the problems we have in our homes? Well, Dad's always gone. And guess what? He's supposed to be the pillar of the home. Five, when it comes to decisions that affect our families in far-reaching ways. People often make those decisions mainly because of monetary considerations and not infrequently with disastrous results for our families. Six, the often used excuse is that although the time we are having to devote to jobs is too much right now, the situation is only temporary. Later, we will have even more time for our families than other people. So when does this quality time with our family start? I'm 50. I got to get after it pretty soon. If you haven't started spending quality time with your family by the time you're 50, you've wasted two-thirds of your life. So the reality is, of course, when does all this kick in? You've got to make it real now. You've got to deal with it in the here and the now. It can't be down the road. The things will be better later. That's what people said for years. And then, you know, and like I said, when I was working for the pharmacy, I'll never forget this. I'm delivering to this one couple pretty regularly, and they lived off back here up beneath in one of these little sort of retirement communities and all that. And I'm delivering to him. He said, you know what? He said, you better enjoy life now. He said, we spent all our lives making money so we could retire comfortably, and now we're spending all our income on doctors and pharmacies. I said, man, that sounds like a good trade. Not. I was like, yeah, good point. So we destroy ourselves physically to get all the things that we think are going to make us happy, and then what have we got at the end of it all? Wrecked bodies, and we're not happy. So we have to step back sometimes. I know it's hard, but again, look at the results if we don't. So seven, this is foolish since we should recognize that the STA is never going to be satisfied. You say, well, my STA is satisfied now. Give it 5 minutes. Eight, the implications of our materialism with respect to our children are nothing short of frightening. A, what kind of values are we passing along to our children by the way we live our lives? And don't think your kids don't see it and don't notice, because they do. B, by our example, we can easily undermine what we say about doctrinal matters being the most important things in our hearts and lives. We talk about doctrine and the important, oh, you need doctrine, you need to apply, you need this and that. But then when the time comes to make the applications, where's mom and dad? Well, they're busy. Doing what? That becomes a question. What? Where are they when it's time to apply, when it's time to step up? Kids see this stuff. They're aware of it. See, when children who are more perceptive than most people think compare our zeal for money and acquiring details with our enthusiasm for the intake and application of doctrine, they do not have any trouble figuring out what we're really after in life. And D, assuming that our efforts to give all our children, quote, the things we never had, are honorable, and they are not, because that's not a biblical principle, it becomes far too easy to just give them basically everything they want or for which they ask. E, this goal is misguided and reflects a lack of discernment with regard to spiritual values. Since we should be teaching our children that material things and worldly pursuits pale in comparison to the true riches of SG3. F, this has the unfortunate effect of ingraining in them a view that this is the way the world works. However, this attitude is out of touch with the reality that they will face in the adult world. G, we should be aware that our kids do not need and will not get 100% of everything they are able to dream of. What they do get will be obtained by working, not by whining and manipulating. Or it should be. Love on South Park. Cartman has whining down to an art form. But Mom! Guess what? Some kids have it down to an art form too. Ah, my favorite verse. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. An American living in the last days, Sheol in the barren womb, earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough. And again, I can't quote it any better than what they said in the movie Wall Street, when it is it enough? It's never enough. The STA is never satisfied. So, well, our time is up, so we'll stop here and continue on with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.